Audio on demand from Vision Christian Media.
The study of prophecy should involve more than just your mind. Look at Daniel, for example. Today on Turning Point, Dr. David Jeremiah explains that when it came to interpreting his visions, David became both intellectually and emotionally involved. Continuing his series in the book of Daniel, The Handwriting on the Wall, here's David to introduce today's message, Antiochus and the Antichrist.
All right, we're going to jump into this really interesting section of Scripture in just a moment in the 8th chapter of Daniel. Well, it's time for us to get started talking about this tyrant. His name is Antiochus Epiphanes. Let's find out what the Scripture says about him.
Now, Daniel's prophecy that we've been studying in the 8th chapter is to the effect that there is an Antichrist coming. And if you remember the plan that we outlined, the 8th chapter is built around three people. Two people of historical significance and one prophetic individual. There are three people in this chapter we need to understand. There is the notable horn. He is also referred to in this chapter as the great horn. He is Alexander the great Greek leader. He illustrates for us the power of the coming Antichrist. He is followed in the text by that one who is referred to in verse 9 as the little horn. And the little horn, according to our understanding, is a reference to someone who grew out of Alexander's empire. Now let's go back for just a moment and review where we have come. You remember that we mentioned that there were four prophecies concerning Alexander and his empire that have literally been fulfilled. The first one had to do with the route to his conquest. He came from the west over the face of the earth, and he touched not the ground, a reference to the rapid way in which Alexander became the conqueror of the world. In just 12 years, he gained control over the whole world, so that at the age of 33, he was the world ruler. We also looked at the prophecy from these first verses concerning the reputation of the king. He's called the notable horn and the great horn. The word horn means ruler or king. And Alexander certainly was a great king, the son of Philip of Macedon, one of the great, great men who ever lived. In 12 years, he became the world ruler, and at 33 years of age, there wasn't anything left for him to conquer. He had done it all. The prophecy also talks about the ruin of the Medo-Persian Empire in verses 6 and 7, and we discussed that. This one came against the Medo-Persian Empire and totally obliterated it, according to the text, stamped upon it and destroyed it. That's exactly what happened. We talked about the remarkable death of this king. The scripture says that at the moment of his strength, when he was strong, he would be killed. And Alexander, when he was 33 years of age, was taken out by God. And then last, we looked at the reorganization of Alexander's empire. And the scripture says that after Alexander was to die, that his empire would be divided among four. They would not have his power, but his kingdom would belong to them. And history records that some 20 years after Alexander's death, after a great deal of infighting among his generals, the kingdom was divided in four. Cassander took part of it, Lysimachus took part of it, Seleucus took part of it, and Ptolemy took the rest. Now we come to the 9th verse, and we read in verse 9 that out of one of them, out of one of those kingdoms, ruled over by one of those kings, came forth a little horn. Now we're going to learn about another man, and this man, according to the prophecy, came out of one of the kingdoms ruled over by one of Alexander's generals. As we look back in history, we now know that that was Seleucus kingdom. He came out of the Seleucids. The scripture records him in verse 9 as a little horn, which grew exceedingly great. He came from insignificance and he became great. He came toward the south and toward the east and then toward the pleasant land is Israel. And he grew great even to the host of heaven and cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. And he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Now when you go back in history and you read the historical sources that are available concerning that period in history, let me say to you that some of them you may have if you happen to have a Douay version of the Bible, which has a section in it called the Apocrypha. And in that apocryphal section, there are two books called 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And those two books are the history of the intertestament period, the 400 silent years from the end of the Old Testament to the New. And those two books record many of the events that we're going to talk about. Now, they are not inspired in that they are not scripture, but they are accurate history of the period of time. And they are also supported by historian Josephus. And when we lay these sources down, we can get an accurate record of the literal fulfillment of the prophecy we have just read. The prophecy is fulfilled in a person history knows as Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes. His name means Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus, God manifest. Antiochus, the great one of God. Now, according to history, he was given to the persecution of people. As we read in the prophecy, he began, first of all, by going in different directions away from Jerusalem. In Egypt, when he was on his way to conquer the world, he was stopped by the armies of Rome. In fury and frustration, Antiochus Epiphanes turned his forces away from Egypt and marched up through the maritime border of the Mediterranean. He was filled with anger because he couldn't do what he wanted to do, and so he vented his anger by taking his army to Jerusalem and sacking the city. Historians tell us that during that march against Jerusalem, Antiochus Epiphanes killed some 80,000 Jews, and he took 40,000 of the people and sold them into slavery. He also plundered the temple. He took the golden altar of incense and stood before the inner veil. He decided to destroy the Jewish religion forever and to substitute for it Greek worship and Greek culture. Notice what the scripture says. Verse 11, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Instead of the Feast of the Tabernacles, Antiochus Epiphanes decided that he would celebrate in the temple the Feast of Bacchanalia, worshiping Bacchus, the god of pleasure and wine. He forced the Jews to observe the Saturnalia, worshiping Saturn, using harlots in the temple for those feast days. He forbade the observance of the Sabbath. He not only forbade the reading of the scriptures, but he burned every copy of the Torah he could get his hands on. It was absolutely forbidden for any of the Jews in the city after Antiochus Epiphanes took control to practice anything Jewish on the penalty of death. He did everything he could do to desecrate their religion and destroy it forever. One Greek general by the name of Jason, under the leadership of Antiochus Epiphanes, decided that he would set up some Greek games right outside the temple. Nothing wrong with that. Maccabees called the game the discus game. I don't really know what that was. Maybe something like the discus in our track meets these days. Anyway, they set that game up right outside the temple, and the scripture says that they forced the priests of the temple to practice and to engage in those games. Now, that doesn't seem like much of a problem. Most good clergymen I know need to get a little exercise during their lunch hour. But if you know anything about Greek culture, you know that in that particular culture, the Olympic Greek games were practiced in stark nakedness. And so all of the people who participated in that game were stripped naked, including the Jewish priests and all those who were part of the Jewish worship. Antiochus Epiphanes forced the Jews to observe all of his feast days and forbid the institution of circumcision. History records in the book of Maccabees that there were two mothers who, because of their deep commitment to their Jewish culture, determined to circumcise their boys. When Antiochus heard about it, he took the babies and killed them, hung them around each mother's neck, marched the women through the city streets of Jerusalem up to the highest wall, and flung them, babies and all, headlong over the wall. In 2 Maccabees, and also in the book of Josephus, we are presented the dramatic story of a mother who had seven sons who defied Antiochus' law, the little horn. First, Antiochus cut the tongues out of these boys' mouths, and then before their mother's eyes fried these boys to death, one at a time on a flat iron. Then they murdered the mother. This is just a short vignette of the long history of agony under Antiochus Epiphanes. Is it any wonder that the Jews who hated this Greek ruler changed his name to Antiochus Epimenes, which means Antiochus the madman? For indeed he was that. In 1 Maccabees 1, 44 to 50, he writes concerning his purposes, and they're clear. And the king Antiochus sent letters by messengers unto Jerusalem and the cities of Judah, that they should follow the foreign customs of the land and keep burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings out of the sanctuary, and that they should profane the Sabbaths and the festival days and pollute the sanctuary and priests and build altars and idol temples and sacrifice swine's flesh and unclean animals, and that they should leave souls abominable with all manner of uncleanness and profanation, to the end that they might forget the law and change the ordinances. What Antiochus Epiphanes was trying to do was to strip the Jews of every semblance of their Jewish faith. When the scripture speaks of the desecration of the temple, it speaks of the moment when Antiochus walked into the sacred place of the Jews with a sow, and he slit the throat of the sow and sacrificed a pig on the altar of the Jewish people. And then he took the juice from that animal and he literally sprayed it all over the inside of the temple. Everything that was holy to the Jews had sow's blood all over it. The Bible speaks of that as the abomination of desolation. Can you think of anything more horrible to a Jew than to have their sacred place profaned by the blood of an unclean animal? In fact, the most unclean animal the Jews would ever know. That was Antiochus. And that was the vision that God gave to Daniel concerning him, as recorded in the first few verses that we just read. And I really believe that Daniel visualized that in his mind much more vividly than I've been able to tell it to you. He saw what was going to happen to his people in a future time as Antiochus the madman came to reign and to rule as the leader of the Greeks and to profane the people. And so as Daniel is thinking about that, and as he's visualizing what's happened, we read in verse 13 that he heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint who spoke, "How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice?" Isn't that the question that would come to your mind? If you were a Jewish saint, a Jewish patriarch, and you saw in your mind's eye a vision concerning the desolation that we've just described, wouldn't you ask in your own mind, "How long can God let this go on? How long will the Lord allow such a terrible thing to happen to his holy place?" Daniel's vision now reveals how long this time of persecution will last. For he heard one saint or an angel speaking, and another asking him how long the time would be. And the answer was, unto 2,300, literally the Hebrew word means evening and morning, or morning and evenings. The thought is that there would be 2,300 such evening mornings before these atrocities would cease. Now, scholars differ in their understanding of that terminology. If we take the 2,300 evenings and mornings to represent morning sacrifice and evening sacrifice, then in order to get the number of days, we have to divide it in half, and that's 1,250 days, and that falls more naturally into the 3.5-year period. Not exactly. If we keep it as 2,300 days, then that's the 7-year period, but either way, you can see how easily it is to lay that in over the tribulation period in the future, for we're dealing with the same basic time periods. Daniel said, as he saw these atrocities in his mind, his question was, "How long can God let this happen?" And God said, through his vision, "The days are numbered. He won't let it go on forever." Now, let me tell you how it ended. This is one of my favorite stories. It's not in the Bible, but it's a great history story. There was living in those days a priest in a place called Modin, town just outside of Jerusalem. The priest's name was Mattathias, And he was a patriarch of patriarchs as far as the Jewish people were concerned, and he literally grieved over the sorrow of his people. Mattathias had five boys: John, Simon, Judas, Eleazar, and Jonathan. One day an emissary from Antiochus came to Modin, where Mattathias lived, and he was coming to make the Jews in that city bow down before the altar of Jupiter, the Greek god. When a Jew came to worship Jupiter, Mattathias looked on him, and the aged priest must have thought he was Moses in Egypt. For he slew the Jew, and then when he got done killing the Jew, he killed the officer that made the Jew bow down. And the Maccabean revolt was on. Well, Mattathias died soon after that as an old man, but he passed the torch of his revolt on to his sons. He gave the torch of liberty and revolution to Judas, who was his third son. And if you've ever read Jewish history, you know all about Judas Maccabeus, whose name means Judas the Hammer. What a patriot he was. And Judas the Hammer was the Jew who would ultimately bring to an end the desecration that Antiochus Epiphanes had wrought upon the temple. He won the victory over Antiochus, and he won the independence for his people. And we still today in our culture see the results of his great victory. Let me explain what I mean. In the story, as Judas Maccabeus went back in to cleanse the temple in 164 BC, the first thing that he wanted to do was to find oil to light the lamps in the temple. And according to tradition, the ceremony that would reconsecrate the temple would take 8 days. But when he only found one cruse of oil, he knew he didn't have enough to last for all that period of time. But tradition says that that one cruse of oil lasted not only for the first day, but it lasted throughout all the days. That day when that event took place was the 25th of Kislev, or the 25th of December, our time. For 8 days, the Jewish people celebrated that feast of reconstruction and dedication of their temple. It meant more to the Jewish people than even the dedication of Solomon's temple meant. They called that feast the Feast of Hanukkah. And today, around our Christmas time, if you know Jewish people and you have Jewish friends, they might greet you with a happy Hanukkah. On the first day of Hanukkah, the devout Jews light a candle. And on the second day, they light a second one. And so on until finally on the eighth day, there are 8 candles burning. It is a sign of victory, deliverance, and dedication. And it goes right back to this period in history that we're studying in the book of Daniel, when Judas Maccabeus, Judas the Hammer, went back into the temple and he reconsecrated and rededicated and cleaned out all the evidences of Antiochus Epiphanes' treachery, and the Jews had a few years of peace before Roman domination came to take over. That feast is also called the Festival of Lights, if you know Jewish history. It is the memory of the discovery of the oil for the temple lamps, and the Jews commemorate that glad day of repossession of their temple by placing candles in their window. I heard a story about the persecutor of the Jews in Russia. One day he asked a Jew what he thought the outcome would be if the wave of persecutions continued, and the Jew answered, "The result will be a feast." He said, "Pharaoh tried to destroy the Jews, and the result was the Passover. Haman attempted to destroy the Jews, and the result was the Feast of Purim. Antiochus Epiphanes tried to destroy the Jews, and the result was the Feast of Dedication." Just try to destroy us, and we'll start another feast. It's sort of an interesting way that God has demonstrated throughout history the special place these people have in his heart. Now, as we have looked at this chapter very quickly, and we've covered vast segments of history, from the leadership of Alexander, who demonstrates for us the power of the coming Antichrist, and Antiochus Epiphanes, who demonstrates for us the cruelty of the coming Antichrist, we now come to the 23rd verse where we see the final person, and he is the one toward whom all of this prophetic information is pointing. There's no purpose to talk about Alexander. if he doesn't represent something else in the future. There's really no information about Antiochus Epiphanes that will do us any good unless, as we see through him, we see out into the future to a person who will be somehow like him. And when you take all of the power of Alexander and all of the cruelty of Antiochus Epiphanes and you magnify that 100 times, you haven't even begun to approach what the Antichrist is going to be like when he comes sometime in the future. Now, let me just say this before we look just briefly at these last few verses. God prophesied through Daniel concerning Alexander, and what he said happened. How did it happen? Figuratively? Spiritually? Or literally? God prophesied concerning Antiochus Epiphanes in words we can all understand, and history validates the prophecy. Was Antiochus Epiphanes a principle? Was he a force, an influence, a concept? He was a person. And just as surely as the prophecies concerning those two men of history came to pass, men and women, the prophecy concerning the king of fierce countenance, who is mentioned in verse 23, will literally come to pass. And the stage is being set even now.
It's amazing how God allows the scripture to be so accurate, and periodically he mirrors folks in the New Testament with people from the Old Testament. Did you know that, for instance, Joseph is a picture of Jesus? And when you study Joseph's life, there are so many comparables to the life of Jesus on this earth. So that's one of the reasons why you should study the whole Bible, not just the New Testament. And don't forget, tomorrow we'll continue our discussion of Antiochus Epiphanes and how he is a prototype of the Antichrist. We love these portions of Scripture because so much of what is there in the old record of Daniel has been proven to be true in history that we now can document since it was written. Did you know that's one of the reasons why skeptics and critics like to do what they call late date the book of Daniel? So what they do is they say the book wasn't written until after all these prophecies were fulfilled, so there's nothing supernatural about them at all. But we know better. We know when Daniel was written, and we know it is a supernatural book. We'll be back to study it more tomorrow. Hope you'll join us then.
For more information on Dr. Jeremiah's series, The Handwriting on the Wall, please visit our website, davidjeremiah.org/radio, where we offer 2 free ways to help you stay connected, our monthly magazine, Turning Points, and our daily email devotional. Sign up today at davidjeremiah.org/radio. That's davidjeremiah.org/radio. When you do, be sure to ask for your copy of David's helpful and encouraging new book, Answers to Questions About Living in the Last Days. It's yours for a gift of any amount. You can also purchase the Jeremiah Study Bible in the English Standard Version, the New International Version, as well as standard or large print in the New King James, all with useful notes and articles by Dr. Jeremiah. Go to davidjeremiah.org/radio for all the details. Join us tomorrow as we continue The Handwriting on the Wall, here on Turning Point with Dr. David Jeremiah.
Thanks for taking time to listen to this audio on demand from Vision Christian Media. To find out more about us, go to vision.org.au.